John Maxwell, the most prolific leadership author of all time, says that people are going to ask you three questions. They're going to ask you three questions. One, do you care for me? Do you care about me? Two, can you help me? And three, can I trust you? They want to know those three questions. Do you care for me? Can you help me? And can I trust you? And if you're a leader that was acting like I was, they're going to know that I didn't care about you. I cared about me. Right? They couldn't trust me because I didn't do what I said I would do as after myself. And I couldn't help them either. I was not interested in helping them. I was helping myself. So I think it's so important as a leader that we take a look at ourselves back, Mike, to your question of being introspective and reflecting and learning that self-awareness about how do you grow over time. And these things don't happen in an event. Leadership is a process.
Welcome to the Empowered Manhood Podcast, where men rediscover courageous masculinity. Pull up a chair as we gain strength from the stories of God working in the lives of ordinary men today. These men have discovered that in a world of superficiality and isolation, we need authentic brotherhood to gain strength for the battles we face every day. Brought to you by the Ministry of CLC, which challenges men to an uncommon pursuit of Christ. Welcome to Empowered Manhood. Hey guys, welcome back to the Empowered Manhood Podcast, where we are helping men rediscover courageous masculinity in the light of the gospel. My name is Mike Hatch. I'm your host again here, as usual, with Chris Bollinger, author and speaker. Chris, welcome back again. Good to be with you, man.
Hey, Mike, how are things up north? Are you unburied?
Dude, yeah, we're unburied, but it's cold. I think I think 9 or 12 is the highest.
I was going to say, you guys are getting single digits right now, right?
Single digits, yep.
Yeah.
When the windshield, or the windshield?
Chill.
Chill, thank you. That's that's what it was.
Believe me, I've lived there long enough to know.
That's what it is. That's playing a factor for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's all good though. We have sun and that's
wow. No, I usually do on the incredibly cold days, you get the sun, at least in Northeast Ohio. And then when it's warmer, you don't see the sun. So
that's right. That's right. Yeah. So, hey, first of all, just wanted to thank our listeners again for tuning in, listening to us, and man, it would be a huge, huge help if you would give us a 5-star review for this podcast. That would help so much. I know whenever I am scrolling through podcasts, looking for a new one or looking for ones, I'm always checking, okay, what are the reviews like? Do they have a lot of 5-star reviews or not? So far, we have 3 5-star reviews. So we're early in the process and we haven't really been pushing that as much. So I want to start mentioning a little bit more, but thank you for those of you, for the 3 of you who have already.
Yeah, it wasn't Mike and me. It was 3 legitimate.
That's right. That's right. Appreciate you doing that. And if you haven't already, please do that and write a review too. That's even more valuable. So again, the decentralized nature of podcasting is really good, but you really need, you need that word of mouth and people spreading the word and sharing it, things like that. So if you're getting anything from the message, ask that you do that for us. That'd be awesome. So with us today, we have author and speaker, Preston Poore. And Preston, I'm not going to go into too many details about in terms of a bio, because I want to have you share a little bit, Preston. We'll kind of banter back and forth, but you are been an executive in you know, higher management roles in companies like Coca-Cola, for example, for a long time. And you are also, by the way, a CLC alumni. So that's exciting as well. And you've written a couple of books, but the one we're really interested in talking about today is the one called Discipled Leader, which we're going to talk about. So Preston Poore, welcome to the Empowered Manhood Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Mike and Chris. I appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting because, of course, our president, Craig Fry, it was like, hey, I can't believe I didn't think about this before, but you got to have Preston Poore on. He's amazing. So, you have not let me down on that, Preston. It's been impressive seeing your website, looking over what you've done, reading a little bit of the book already. seeing your podcast. I already really resonate with your heart. So.
Well, I appreciate that, but we still have a little bit to go in the interview, and I'm sure I'll disappoint you at some point. So we'll be good.
We'll edit that out.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it's probably going to be mutual. So. So Preston, you are a CLC alum. You've been through it before. So you know what we're talking about when we ask you to share your fence post story, which we do with each one of our guests to begin with. Sure. And for those of you who are just tuning in, maybe for the first time, think about a fence along a property, and every vertical post representing a significant moment in your life or significant person in your life who's shaped who you are today. And so we're excited, Preston, to hear a little bit about your fence post story. Now, sometimes these stories can go on for an hour. Now, so Preston, we're not looking for that. We're not going to, if it's going somewhere good, we're not going to slow it down. But anyway, I think I told you 5 to 10 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, Mike, and I appreciate that. And we'll give the elevator version, elevator speech. Not that we're in elevators anymore, but that's still an analogy, still works, hopefully, right? But I think the thing I want to relate to everybody here, if you've been a CLC grad or part of CLC or thinking about it, when I started back in 2007, one of the first things we did is we took all, 13 or 14 guys up into a cabin. Did a retreat, and we each had 1 hour to tell our life story. So I'm not going to tell you my life story today.
Yeah.
But man, you got really deep on that. You got to know people, transparency, vulnerability that goes along with that connection, community. And that's really how you break down the barriers between people, that initial thing. So I'll never forget that. I've done it twice actually, because as a CLC participant and then as a facilitator as well. Quite the opportunity. But here's the skinny. I'll share the fun stuff with you. This may be different than just a timeline and fence post thing or milestones. First and foremost, I'm a husband and a dad. I've been married almost 30 years, which is kind of a neat accomplishment. I met my bride, Carla, when I moved here to Alabama from Colorado years ago. There's a whole story behind that. But since we're in the elevator speech right now, I won't give that to you. I've got 2 kids and a son-in-law now. My daughter just got married 2 weeks ago, so it's great.
We've got congratulations.
Thank you, living here in Atlanta, Georgia. As you mentioned, Mike, I've been in the consumer packaging industry for like 25 years. So I've sold everything from chocolate with Hershey chocolate. Actually lived in Hershey for a couple of years there in Pennsylvania. I love the area, central PA. I've sold dog food with Ralston Purina, and also with the Coca-Cola company and all the great beverages that we offer. So I've had a really cool career. I've also worked with the John Maxwell team, and I have a certification there for public speaking and coaching and training. And then also spent time with the Dale Carnegie organization. If you've ever heard the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. I've got this bent to develop other people and things like that. We can talk more about that later. Just a couple other cool facts, and I'm going to move into some real, real heart things that I'll share with you in just a second. I am a minority share owner of a couple things. One is a company called Numerica. My dad started about 25 years ago, and it's an air, missile, and space defense company in Colorado. And my brother runs it. My wife works for it. My mom used to work for it. My sister-in-law works for it. We've got like 80 people out there. And my dad is a Caltech graduate, and he discovered how to track things in the sky. And so he can actually, the technology can track missiles, can track satellites in the sky and all kinds of stuff. So my dad started that, and I have the good fortune of being part of that organization on the board of directors. So I've got this big corporate experience, and I've also got small business in two totally different industries. So it takes a lot of different hats to wear against that. Yeah. Last things I'll mention real quick, just for the audience, just to make connections out there. I'm a Sigma Chi in fraternity. So a lot of folks out there might be listening are Sigma Chi's as well. I'm a son of the American Revolution. Maybe you've heard the Daughters of American Revolution. Right. I had a relative fight in the American Revolution, actually 6 that we can trace it back to.
Wow.
And because of that genealogy study against that, I found out I'm a distant relative of the one and only Humphrey Bogart.
Humphrey Bogart.
Believe that? Yeah. Yeah.
That is amazing.
Isn't that cool? Wait,
I don't know why you make that more prominent on your website. That's
like what? I mean, big deal, right? Yeah.
I can see the resemblance, by the way.
Yeah, thanks. Just no Academy Awards or movies with me either. So it's all good.
Yeah.
But the reason I share all those things is those are kind of the neat things. But I think as we talk as men, we always want to talk about what we've got going for us. And this Facebook, Instagram environment, TikTok, we always look good on the surface, right? But there are things that make us up. that create us, they shape us. And there's four things that I tell people. And I've actually, I've been able to share this even in a corporate environment, not just in a Bible study or CLC or church environment. I've been able to share this in front of groups at work. And it takes some courage to do this. There's four things I tell people. Number one, there's one thing that makes me and three that shape me. Number one that makes me. And that's when I became a Christian in eighth grade. I gave my life to the Lord in a junior high ministry. I heard the gospel a few times and surrendered my life to him. And my life hasn't been the same since. Much better. It's not been easy, but it's been good. And so I follow the Lord Jesus Christ. But there are three things that shape me that happened in my life. Number one, I was born. That might seem like a big deal to you, but I was actually an unplanned pregnancy. And I don't share this very often because of some privacy concerns my mom has and stuff like that. But I want to be vulnerable and transparent with the audience. My mom actually had an abortion before Roe v. Wade planned.
Wow.
And she said a couple weeks before she actually went, she just had this feeling come over her saying, don't do this. And she couldn't explain it. And she still can't explain it to this day. But my mom went ahead and had me. My dad made her an honest woman. They got married and have been wonderful parents and provided for me all the way. But, you know, when you find something out about like that late in life, because they didn't hide it from me, but I just never figured it out until later in life that, you know, if you put the dates together and all that, things just kind of didn't make sense. Like an anniversary that's like 6 months away from your birthday. You know,
right.
I didn't think that way. So I'm not that bright. So it took me a while to figure that one out. But my point in telling the audience this is that for me, I've always had this sense of purpose and mission because I feel like, you know, I was born for a reason. I don't have a stamp on me or anything like that. But I'm like, you know, a decision could have been made that has been made for, gosh, I read the newspaper article this morning, 62 million abortions since Roe v. Wade. Right. And I'm not going to get political on that, but I want to personalize the story that I'm an individual that came out of a positive decision for life. Wow. And what an opportunity I have. And so I feel like I owe that back to God and to my family. I'm not perfect at it. I can be a jerk a lot of times, self-absorbed, but other times I try to give and I'm seeking him and that's where I want to go. So that's the number one thing that kind of shapes me. Hey, number two, and I know we didn't want to make this too long.
No, you're fine. You're doing great. You're doing great.
Okay. Hey, the second thing is when I was born with a genetic disease called Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease. And it's the most unheard of, most common genetic disease that's out there. 1 in 2,500 people have it. And if you ever watched a Jerry Lewis muscular dystrophy telethon when we were kids, or ever heard of that, it's not muscular dystrophy, but it's under the same family. And it's genetic for me. What it does, it impacts my peripheral nerves, especially my legs and balance and all that. So I have a weakness down there and does some funny stuff with my feet and all that. But so it's a handicap, right? It's a physical challenge that I have. So that shapes me because that's that thorn in the side like Paul has. I've asked God, hey, take it away. And he said, nope, not doing it. I didn't do it for Paul. Certainly can't do it for you kind of thing. Just joking there. But
what types of restrictions does that place on you, Preston? I'm just curious. You know,
thank you, Chris, for asking the question. It's progressive in nature. So when I was growing up, I've had two what they call tendon transfer surgeries. And so what they did is they took a tendon on the top of my foot. The first surgery, they took two and put them on, moved them down to the right side of my foot. So it created some stability.
Okay.
So I had that my senior year in high school. My senior year in college, I said, this isn't working. I love to ski. I grew up in Colorado. I can't get my foot in a boot anymore. And when I do, it's very uncomfortable. So they made an adjustment for me. Still didn't feel great, but I still have that. And so I walk with a limp. It's not a noticeable gait. I run, I play sports, do all that fun stuff. I bike and everything. So, and my condition's a lot lighter, but I also feel like I have a voice for the people that do have that concern. So it hasn't impacted me in such a bad way. What it has done, Chris, though, it's made me discover other talents, skills, and abilities that I have. I'm very competitive. I love sports, but it forced me into things like writing, speaking and developing, discovering those other talents that I have to help others. So hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, and there's one more thing I'd mention to the audience that I think is really important is that I was bullied when I was little. I was. And I've written about that. I've got a blog out there about it. And for a long time, and it was physical, verbal abuse and all kinds of stuff. I was a 5'2" scrawny kid with a smart mouth, if you will. And not good for me to have a smart mouth, but I was threatened and all kinds of stuff in junior high and high school. Funny thing is growing up in that, and that certainly impacts you as you go through it, but I grew into this 6'1" frame that ended up being 210 pounds in college or whatever. And I became the pounder at my fraternity. And so I was the bully of pledges in the fraternity. So it was a kind of a total reverse of being a little scrawny kid and then growing into something, saying, okay, now I'm going to take it out on the pledges and be a jerk to them. And God's really had to break me of a lot of those things about being intimidated and the scars that came from that. But that's my fence post story. Neat stuff up front, but I want the audience to know that as a man, there are things that shape me, that God has been integral and with me all along. We all have challenges. We all have baggage. But if we lean into him and trust him, he will use those things that we consider weaknesses to prove out to be strengths. And I'm so thankful for that.
Wow. Man, thank you for sharing that, Preston. That's amazing. I get, of course, there are going to be men who are, driving their cars right now, listening to this, thinking, holy cow. Yeah. That sounds like me too. I experienced something very similar to that.
Yeah. I connect with that last point. Cause I grew really late. When I was a freshman, I think I was 5'1" and I'm 6'2" now, but yeah, I dealt with similar issues when I was in junior high and high school, which was, I think I was the shortest guy in my class until senior year. So
yeah,
it does shape you. It does affect you even when you are tall later. I still consider myself a short guy, which is odd because I'm 6'2" and a half, but yeah, you can't shake that. It becomes a part of your fabric.
Oh, sure. It's that little kid inside that was impacted that way. Yep. But the good news in all that is that God can heal those things and change those over time and use that for a positive piece in others' lives. And we can talk more about this later as we go through it and talk about my career. But one of the things that ticks me off is when I see injustice in the workplace, or workplace bullies, and I still get my gander up on all those things and I want to fight back and I have to figure out how to work through some of that stuff. So it's still a good challenge.
Yeah, I'm going to want to revisit that because I know that's a part of your story and impetus for writing the book, The Disciple Leader. And by the way, I'm still waiting for God to heal me for not growing me any taller than 5'1".
Love it.
It's at a daily struggle.
You guys got to catch up. I'm still back here, guys. I'm still, you left me behind anyway.
But my college athletic career was I was never able to do the things I wanted to do because I was too short for basketball, especially. I was actually cut my junior year in high school and I'm still living with those scars.
Still reeling from it, Chris. I'm sorry. I'll have to therapy session for you on that.
All right. So Preston, let's talk about the book and I'm shifting, but I know your story is going to interweave as we do talk about it, which I'm looking forward to. What was your impetus for writing Disciple Leader?
It started as just as this idea is that how does discipleship influence leadership? And I started with CLC back in 2007, and a great guy named Dave Bianconi was my leader. I know he's well known in the CLC world, but he was actually my facilitator for two and a half years. And I actually served with him as an elder at our church after that. So wonderful mentor and very much appreciated. But when I came out of CLC, I was inspired by some content that Hal Haddon had included in his material. And it was really just a brief outline of discipleship. And I was moving the Coca-Cola company. I was moving through a reorg, and I tell everybody, and I'm sure this is probably true for a lot of companies out there, but working at my company right now is like running for Congress. Every 2 years, you're up for re-election. You're re-elected, you have to run for your office again. So there's that continual cycle. And in one of those cycles, we were moved from Knoxville, Tennessee to Atlanta. And guys, I know there's men on the call today that when you were traveling and you will travel again, or if you are right now, there's a lot of moments we have with ourselves in hotel rooms. And you have a decision to make there. You have to ask yourself, if I go down this path, is it worth it? Or how can I invest my time? And God was stirring in my heart to do something a little bit different than the normal stuff, watching TV or whatnot, going down some not so good paths, the private thought life and everything else that goes on. And so I'm not going to go down that path right now, but I know that men know what I'm talking about if you travel. So I was sitting in my hotel room and said, okay, well, I'm going to write a book on discipleship. Right. And so I started that, not very good. Stuff stank. It was bad, but I start honestly, it was bad, bad stuff. And I started writing though. And I think the best thing to do is just to begin. That's what the thing happened about those 10 plus years ago. I just began writing and I got a Mac and I started typing in the hotel room. My nights became consumed with research and writing and all that stuff. And it was actually really a good exercise for me. Now, interestingly enough, as I went through it, I counseled with all kinds of people on the book, and it was going to be a discipleship book, but guys, how many discipleship books are actually out there in the marketplace? A million, right? There's a bunch. There's countless discipleship books over the ages. But where I found my niche is on not only discipleship, but then how do you show up in the workplace? And it's interesting. A lot of the stories that are in the book happened after the move. And as I was starting to write the book, circumstances I encountered that I struggled with, like needing an executive coach when I was about to get fired and reversing things. And I'm transparent about that in the book and the learnings around all that sanctification and what God was using and all that. So that's how the book started, Mike. It was out of a hotel room, out of a desire to write something on discipleship. And then how do I bless other men? Oh, and the other thing is that I love CLC. I do. And I know that Craig and the team are adjusting curriculum to shorter stints. But I went through a two and a half year thing, which I consider an MBA basically on Christian living, if you will. And I was like, how could we whet people's appetites for discipleship? And this was one way that I'm trying to contribute to the overall overall God's work and what he's doing and try to get people interested in discipleship.
Yeah, I love that. There's I'm tied in with a I think I may have connected you with one of the guys who leads our Truth at Work roundtable. It's a CEO roundtable. And been involved in that for a while. And so, and I know some of the listeners to this podcast, some of the guys are in corporate America, some entrepreneurs, business leaders in the community. And so that, I think that's what I'm kind of excited to dive in a little bit more deeper with you in terms of that, because I think there's gonna be a lot of guys who can relate to your perspective coming from that. You tell the story in your book about, I think it's right at the beginning, maybe it's even in the introduction, about a time where you had taken on a new management role, and maybe it was during one of these reorgs potentially, and you got some pretty harsh feedback from a couple people who you were overseeing, and they left, and maybe even partially because of you in some ways. Can you share a little bit about that and how that led you to, because you talk about how it led you to kind of some self-reflection. And I just think some of the guys, especially the guys that I just described, would love to hear you share about that and relate to it.
Yeah. So thank you for the question. This is really the heart of where I am on this and getting at it. I always thought that if I performed well, I'd be promoted and do well in the organization. It was performance related.
Right.
I saw people as a means to an end in the work environment. Now, I treated my family totally different, right? I had this secular and sacred and secular divide. It's always hard for me to say that. Say that three times, sacred and secular divide.
That's tricky.
Yeah, tricky one. But I had that compartmentalization thing going on. And I had to learn over time that, you know, to integrate my faith in the workplace. But, as I went through that, I got promoted because I performed. I was a top performer in the organization. And that happens in so many companies. But the challenge is people don't know how to lead others, let alone manage things. Management's totally different than lead, too, right? There are management functions that you do, organize, blah, blah. You know, there's all kinds of things that you do around that, prioritize for people. You can name them. But leadership's totally different. And when I got into a leadership and a management role, I stunk at leadership. And I tried to replicate myself with those two individuals that I first got responsibility for. And it was rough. And I had somebody come on my team that was a non-performer. And so I had to put I was told to put the hammer down. And then somebody else that I hired to replace my old role where I got promoted from, I brought somebody from totally outside the industry, and I couldn't spend any time with that individual. And that individual developed not a good reputation. And so they didn't perform as well. So I got caught on all this stuff, right? And having to manage up, manage down, and lead well, and work with and through others instead of trying to use them to accomplish your means and your end and what you want to do, instead of looking at them, developing them, as valuing them as individuals, and helping them achieve their goals and having them buy in on a common vision, shared purpose, values, et cetera. So I missed all of that. I really did. So it was a rough experience. And I share in the book that I'll never forget the day I went into an office with my manager, my manager, direct manager, and I were going to do a year-end review. And I was sitting in the office, had all my papers there, and I was about to state my case about why the individual didn't do what they needed to do and how they needed to prove. And I was going to show that person and do all that. And my manager hadn't come in yet. And I got the individual on the phone and we started talking. And then all of a sudden the individual says, "Hey, Preston, I quit. You're condescending. You're a jerk. I'm done," and hung up. Even before we got going in on it.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, not good. And so my manager, and soon after that, the other person quit too. And so I was certainly concerned about my job and career and everything else there. And that individual, my manager, went down to do some investigating about what happened, came back and said, "Hey, look, if you want to continue in this organization to rise through the ranks, like I know you want to, you're going to have to fix some things." That individual gave me the liberty to work with an executive coach. And I explore that really in chapter 9 about the exchange life and sanctification and what happened and really how that all turned around. So that's kind of maybe a little longer answer on that story. But I think the thing I'd share with most folks that are out there, men and or women, often if you're a leader and you're picking somebody to go into a new leadership, early entry-level leadership role or management role, you can't just put them in there because they're a top performer, right? There's got to be some development before that to help them develop their influence skills and how they treat people and lead people well and demonstrate that before they actually get into that, because otherwise there's a tough transition. And then I think as an associate, you've got to know that it's not just your manager that you need help with to do that, but you've got to seek out those things and not think just because I'm a top performer, I can do this too, which wasn't the case.
So I'm guessing that a couple things changed when you had that meeting with your manager and, you know, you sought an executive coach. What are the main things that changed? Was it your perspective on people that reported to you? What changed first and foremost that really made you a better leader, a better manager?
Thanks for asking, Chris. You know, that was a breaking point for me. And Mike, I don't know if you read this in the introduction or whatnot, but I wrote in my journal a very low point for me and said, "Hey, I'm broken because of this. I thought I was succeeding. I thought I was getting traction." And I was like, "Lord, I know this is not what you made me for. I know that there's more to all this. And I am going to surrender myself to you in the workplace and with other people if you will just take shape and mold me." And Chris, it was in that breaking where I bowed and I said, "God, I give up. I don't know what else to do. I can't keep going around and trying to make myself look good. And this all happened and nothing's going to happen in my career and I'm not going to go anywhere." And it wasn't about trying to get somewhere in a career, but I realized it was a heart issue for me. And so it was really, Chris, it came down to surrender. And then the executive coach that I got with, Jenny Hale, actually I spoke with her last year, wonderful, but all this happened like, gosh, 15 years ago or whatnot. And we just reconnected because we caught each other on LinkedIn. But Jenny was great to coach me over those, 4 months. And we'd meet once a month and she'd give me reflective questions. And I had to literally think about and pray about and seek God. And I started, and when I say seek, I might have been having quiet times, but I was just, my eyes were scanning the page. I wasn't really praying, engaging and seeking God. And I started doing that after that breaking point. And that's when God started this. And it's a common theme in my life. I get injured, I screw something up, and then he goes through this rehabilitation process. Mm-hmm. He says, "Okay, come here a minute. Let me show you how this is done or how we can work through you and in you." And so that helped me. But if I hadn't gone through those things, I, number one, wouldn't have the testimony that I have and the stories that I have now to share. But two, God shaped and molded me so he could use me in the workplace to be a positive influence. And that's kind of where I am now. So I tell people all the time, Chris, that if you ask about Preston Ford maybe 15 years ago and you worked with him, what was your recollection? They'd probably say he was a jerk, and which is fair. I got it. But I know a lot of those people also watch me grow and mature on it, and personally and professionally. And if you asked him now, my hope is they would say that, hey, Preston is a leader in the organization, not necessarily from a role perspective, but an influencer. And it makes a positive difference.
You know, when you say that, this is so funny. You say that, like, as you get promoted and people are promoted within business because they're high performers, yet they can't lead. It's funny when you look at it from that perspective. Yeah, you can say, oh yeah, I guess that can be an issue. But you know who really is perceptive about seeing that are the employees who watch these things play out, you know, above them, and they see clear as day. They're like, I can't believe that guy got that promotion to oversee us. Like, what are they thinking? It's so funny how to some group it can be very clear, but to another group who has limited perspective because they're in a higher rank of some sort that it.
Yeah, Mike. The way I look at that, Mike, is that some people, there's 360 leadership. So you've got people above you, below you, and beside you. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people out there that are very good about managing up.
Yep.
Right. And I think that don't take that wrong. Is a good leader in an organization, as you progress and as the Lord's working in you and through you, there are politics involved. You've got to recognize that. You have to learn how to positively influence up. Yeah. But there are folks out there that are just managing, you know, smoozing and all that kind of stuff to get where they want to go. And they're good at managing up.
Yeah. But what I love about what you just shared is that you got introspective about it. You were humbled, you were broken, I think is right. What you used. And I think not a whole lot of guys, especially in the business world, are able to do that, which kind of leads me to my next question is, why do you think guys in business, in the corporate America, some might say, why is it so hard for them to reach that point where they can take kind of a critical look at themselves and be humbled?
Yeah, I think a lot of it's the way we're wired, to be honest with you, in the competitive environments that we grow up in and expectations that are put. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah.
You know, for me, it was a question of how do I become a man after God's own heart? And if I really meant that, is that integrated not only throughout my family, but it's also in my community, at my church, it's at work, nonprofit organization, charity, whatever, wherever I am, I'm the same person. And it's not like I flipped a switch and said, hey, I'm going to be this person today in this environment and a chameleon and do something different another. It was a learned behavior. The other thing I'd mention to the audience is that I've noticed there's just a lack of courage in the workplace to express your faith, to live out your faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have numbers on it necessarily. Meaning that, you know, I've talked to people in C-suites before that are believers, and they are scared to death that if they say anything or mention the name Jesus, they will be punted out.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they're in a tough situation. They want to provide for their families and all that kind of stuff, but they just don't have the courage to live out their faith. Now, when I say that, guys, I don't mean that you've got to walk down or stand on the corner of a hallway and preach the gospel as people come in and off the elevator. Oh, there goes that elevator thing again. I apologize.
Yeah, right.
But it means, how do you show up at work? How do you treat other people? I always tell people, and I learned this at Coke. This was a wonderful lesson I learned. The how you do something is much more important than what you do. Hmm. Let that sink in for a minute. The how you do something is much more important than what you do. Why is extremely important. That's purpose and mission. You can talk about that later if you want, but the how you do something, how you treat other people, the way you approach things, the way you think about things, how do you do those things matter? Because I remember James Dobson saying something to the effect that he went into his old high school. If everybody, the listeners know, remember Focus on the Family and James Dobson, but he made this comment about how he was a tennis star at high school And he went back for a reunion, and he saw they were cleaning out the showcase in the hallway with all the trophies. And he saw his tennis tournament trophy that he'd won in the trash can. Right. And so that was a reminder to him saying, hey, I accomplished that. That's neat. But that people don't remember that. My trophy's in the trash can. But what is important is the way that you treat people. The way that you treat people. And there's another thing I leave with on this, just as I go down a rabbit trail. John Maxwell, the most prolific leadership author of all time, who I'm part of his team, have been thankful for that since 2016 and had read his stuff before that, says that people are going to ask you three questions. They're going to ask you three questions. One, do you care for me? Do you care about me? Two, can you help me? Can you help me? And three, can I trust you? They want to know those three questions. Do you care for me? Can you help me? And can I trust you? And if you're a leader that was acting like I was, they're going to know that I didn't care about you. I cared about me, right? They couldn't trust me because I didn't do what I said I would do as after myself. And I couldn't help them either. I was not interested in helping them. I was helping myself. So I think it's so important as a leader that we take a look at ourselves back, Mike, to your question of being introspective and reflecting and learning that self-awareness about how do you grow over time. And these things don't happen in an event. Leadership is a process.
Hey guys, this is Mike Hatch. And if you are a pastor or a men's ministry leader and you're looking for a discipleship curriculum that is both affordable and accessible, I'd love to tell you more about CLC's newest curriculum line called Getting Real, a small group guide to spiritual authenticity. This study is designed for groups of 5 to 8 men meeting weekly to get real about life's victories and struggles. It's divided into 3 sessions of 12 weeks each that cover the nature of God, daily living, and the big picture. I recently started 2 Getting Real groups myself, and the $50 price tag as well as the 12-week commitment made it much easier and accessible for guys to want to jump in. This is the perfect study for guys who maybe have never been in a group before. And don't worry, this study still contains all the amazing things that make a CLC study a CLC study, like fence post stories, scripture memorization, and affirmation experiences. You can find out more about this study at our website at clchq.org or shoot me an email at mhatch@clchq.org. I'd love to talk to you about the study and how to integrate it into your own church's discipleship strategy. That's all for now, so let's get back to the interview.
Yeah, Preston, you mentioned something a couple minutes ago that struck me, which was compartmentalization. And I think that I've always been really good or really bad at compartmentalizing. I think that a lot of men do this, which is that to be successful at a task, especially, you have to kind of tune out. You have to really focus. And I think that gets rewarded a lot of times in the workplace. You mentioned, you know, guys get promoted because they're effective, but I think a lot of times it's effective at tasks or projects or, you know, getting that product out the door. And, you know, that gets rewarded, but it took you kind of hitting a wall and being found out or discovering that while you were succeeding at particular things, you were not succeeding in developing people. And I found that out too. And I think that that's pretty common. So I was struck by what's oftentimes seen as a strength is really a weakness when you rise to a position of influence in the workplace. Can you comment on that? Does that make sense?
Sure. I think, Chris, the things that come to mind when you say those things are, how do you move from a success mindset to a significance mindset?
Right, right.
Right. And how do you, while you might achieve great things, you need to move into significance. And what I mean by significance, that's making a positive difference in your environment and with the people that you're with.
Right. Right.
Leaving a lasting legacy imprint, impact on people and things around you. And so that's that shift that has to take place in perspective against all that. I'll give you a quick story that comes to mind. I had the opportunity of speaking in front of 250 Sigma Chi brothers and wives and all kinds of stuff at their 100th anniversary of our fraternity chapter. And I was really honored to come in. I had a chance to share a little bit about the gospel and the Lord and a story. But I tell a story because I started this whole conversation with, hey, all this, the sexy stuff that you might see up front, the resume stuff, there's things that go on behind the scenes for all of us. And I went on a mission trip down to Tijuana with our church fellowship in Knoxville, Tennessee. And that's the one David Bianconi's part of. And went down with Rick Dunn, the pastor, and took my son down there. And we went and stayed in an orphanage in Tijuana. And then we went into the dump. And I don't know if you knew this, but there are hundreds of people that live in the dump in Tijuana. And they're folks that scavenge things in the dump and they build houses. And what we did is we went around and gave rice and beans and stuff. But one of the coolest events that we did was where we helped with hygiene. And so we were going to wash people's hair. Think about it. You live in a dump. You don't have water. You don't have soap. Probably not brushing your teeth like normal American does every day. Hopefully they brush their teeth normally every day. But they don't have those conveniences. And what a luxury to wash hair. So it's interesting when it comes down to a personal testimony and the experience against all this stuff. The women all lined up. They had buckets of water and shampoo. And the women that were the missionaries all lined up. And they had their gloves on. They were doing all that kind of stuff. And then it came time for the men. And so Juan walked up and I looked him in the eye. Actually, I tried to look him in the eye and I didn't want to go up there, guys. I was scared to death to wash a man's hair, right? Yeah. What, are you kidding me? Come on. Got lice in it and that kind of stuff. And this is just, you know, isn't for me. I'm Fortune 500 corporate guy. So anyway, I went over to him and actually he didn't look me in the eye either. He knew this was kind of a man to man type thing. And he was, he was being very humbled to come do what he was asking somebody to wash his hair. And so I washed his hair and did it to the best of my ability and hopefully did a good job on it. But the point of the whole story is this, that Juan, he stood up and looked at me mano a mano and in the eye. And I could tell he just looked at me and he said, gracias. In that moment, I realized, Preston, I stepped out of my comfort zone into a discomfort zone. I did something that may not be considered successful, but it was something that was significant because I made a difference in that young man's life. Something simple by hygiene and washing his hair, but it was serving him. And so, Chris, to answer your question, if you move from a success mindset to significance mindset, you want to create waves out there and make a difference, you serve others. And give your very best to them and help them succeed. And ultimately, I bet it benefited me more, honestly, than it did Juan.
Right. But you may not be rewarded in the short term, because I've seen this in the workplace. There was a manager when I was early in my career who was, he was the best manager on the floor and probably the best manager in the company. He was just excellent at helping those who reported to him succeed. And many of them were promoted either in technical ways or into managerial roles. And this man ultimately was laid off because the company did not value that type of management. The company valued, you know, projects being successful and moving things forward, you know. And he ended up finding a job at another company. I mean, I know him very well. But I think you have to be willing to give up those goals of personal success if you're gonna serve. I mean, you know, I think about Jesus washing the disciples' feet, you know, the greatest leader ever who humbled himself as an example for us to show us what servant leadership is and how unwilling I was to do that in most of my career. Now I think eventually I progressed to the point where I was willing to help to sacrifice, if you will, some of my own success to help those who were under me, who were reporting to me, to make them successful. But it took a long time for me to reach that point because I was rewarded for most of my career by, you know, my personal success by pushing things forward in the company from a number standpoint.
Yeah. So let me go back real quick. And I don't want to mitigate results at all.
Right.
And so I'm not proposing an or. I'm not proposing you serve people or you are successful at work.
Right.
Right. I'm proposing an and. An and. And what I mean by that is, that, again, I go back to the how and what. If you could figure out the how first and do that well, and then drive and deliver results with and through your people, you'll always be valued by the company.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If you're just the people person only, but you're not delivering results or marginal results, well, I hate to tell you, it is a business world and they're going to make decisions based.
Right.
Right. So, and you want to help people, you want to help people be successful in their careers against that. I remember a guy named Sandy Douglas at the Coca-Cola company, and I was sharing this with somebody a long time ago, that Sandy was the president of Coca-Cola North America. I remember early in my career, he said something to the effect that, and somebody asked him about the stock price. Stock price, you know, wasn't doing as well as he thought, or the group did, or the question came out. And Sandy looked at the crowd and said, hey, look, if we do all these things right, the things, the plans that we have in place, the stock price will take care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And my point in saying that is that if you do all these things, the process, like Nick Saban says, with Alabama football, people may not like Nick Saban. I apologize. My wife's an Alabama graduate, by the way, so I got to throw that out there. Roll Tide. But if you do the process right and do those things well, the results, the scoreboard or whatnot, will take care of itself.
Right.
And that's the way you, that's the mindset you have to have.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, that's excellent.
So we probably going to wrap up here in just a few minutes. But I definitely wanted to get to this question. Because I mean, it's the title of your book. So tell us, how would you define what a discipled leader is?
Yeah, a discipled leader is somebody that is following Christ and influencing their workplace from a positive perspective. Hmm. What the discipled leader really tries to do is it gives a framework, Mike, for people that are maybe stuck in their Christian life. And they need a framework to help them understand how that they can become a redemptive Christ-like presence in the workplace and live a more fulfilling life. I want to go back, and this would be a great point to close on, Chris, because you mentioned this compartmentalizer thing. Y'all heard of Barna before? Their research, Christian research, research. I go with the words again, research organization. Sound like I got dentures, doesn't it? Research. Research. This is question part I. Sorry about that. Anyway, you can cut that or leave that in. That'll be fun. But here's the point. Barna did a survey with Abilene Christian University of 1,500 business people, and they had to have faith matter to them some level, right? So whether it was. And they found that there were three buckets of people out there in terms of showing up at work, how your Christian walk with the Lord influenced your work. And they found three buckets. Number one were compartmentalizers. They found that there were about 35% of the people out there that totally see Sunday different than they do on Monday. They just don't understand. They don't have a strong relationship with the Lord. And they say, hey, I don't get, there's no reason for me to do that to influence the workplace. There's a second bucket. That's the onlookers. And those are folks that are looking from the outside in at work from a perspective, hey, if somebody modeled for me and showed me how to be a Christian business leader and mentored me in that, I'd be willing to actually go and integrate my faith in the workplace. The last bucket, it was 28%. So 72% of people don't integrate their faith in the workplace. 28% actually do. They seek the Lord in their decisions they make, the way they treat people, the results they're delivering, all that kind of stuff. So you've got those three buckets along the way. And what disciple leader tries to do is to take those three different types of people out there. If you're a compartmentalizer, studies show that 80% of Christians have not been discipled. What disciple leadership tries to do is to give a business leader foundational discipleship principles like praying, sharing your faith, fellowship with other believers, those types of things, reading the Bible, and equipping you with those things to live a more effective and personal and spiritual life. You move into the onlooker, it provides a way to see, okay, how do those biblical principles actually show up in the workplace from a leadership perspective? What does that actually look like? And it gives that piece. And then if you're an integrator and you are integrating your faith, it gives you a framework to go back and help those onlookers and integrators become Christians in the workplace and effective Christian workers in the workplace. So that's the whole, I guess, mission behind the book. is how do I disciple people? How to provide a strong role model for other people to experience what it looks like to be a Christian in the workplace, regardless of what level you are. I'm not actually after CEOs. If a CEO read it, that'd be great. I'm speaking from a middle management type piece. There's a lot of folks that aren't CEOs that could benefit from this. And then the third one was those integrators. How do you have a framework to actually sit down and disciple somebody, mentor somebody to become more effective, not only in their walk with the Lord, an intimate fellowship with him, but also effective in your workplace?
Preston, one of the biggest groups, I think it was the biggest group, was the onlookers. Is that right? And it was at least 30%.
So the integrators and onlookers are about 34 or 35% apiece.
Okay.
Right on there. Mm-hmm.
So I was an onlooker for a long time, right? I knew I needed to start living out my faith more visibly in the workplace. And every now and then we had a Bible study for a while at one of my places of employment. But I was still kind of on the sidelines, right? I wasn't. Can you give a couple of steps that an onlooker like me can take just to start to get outside my comfort zone and start to, I'm not going to go all the way to discipling another person in the workplace, but what are some things I can do to start living out my faith a little more visibly in the workplace?
Absolutely. I've got two, but I'm going to start with one example. It's the first chapter in the book. It's called Seek. All of the chapters start with one word, and they're verbs, right? As we actively participate with God in this discipleship and sanctification process. Those are big theological words, but it's just God working in you and through you around that. Here's what I would say, Chris. We all make decisions, don't we, on a daily basis. The question is, how do you become a better decision maker? And in the first chapter, I talk about seeking God. And what I do in that is I initially take people through the importance of the Bible, that it's inspired by God, the role of the Holy Spirit in our life. And then I say, you know what? The number one missing factor in decision making for believers is, you know what it is? Don't worry, it's kind of rhetorical. It's that they don't seek God. I did a survey, and only 60% of people, when they make a decision, they seek the Lord's wisdom, insight, guidance, et cetera. They don't seek divine input. And so I talk about, if the Bible is what it says it is, and the Holy Spirit works in you and through you, why aren't we spending more time making sound decisions? And believe it or not, then I give a framework in the book as a leader for you to actually make decisions. And I've got a 5-step process just real quick on that. Number one, you have to define the decision. And what I mean by that is you have to write down your problem statement or the decision you're trying to make.
Right.
Number two is brainstorm. That's the B. It's DBDAE is the acronym, but B is brainstorm. And so you got to come up with a number of different solutions potentially, and
right,
the criteria on the decision. Number three, you got to actually decide and make the decision. I got like a 9-step process to make sure that's a great decision. Number four is act. Act. No decision is actually made until it's converted into action.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one is E. E is examine. And I take a phrase, I know that CLC listeners are probably familiar with a phrase from Socrates. He said, the unexamined life is not worth living. Maybe you've heard that before.
Right.
I put a spin on it and say, the unexamined decision is not worth making.
Mm.
And what I mean by that is that you've got to go back and take a look. And I know in the corporate America, we're moving so quickly all the time, quarter to quarter, blah, blah, blah. But you've got to go back and look at least at your significant decisions to see if they worked, they didn't work, what can you improve, what do you change,
right,
et cetera. So I take people all the way from the theological piece about the Bible, the Holy Spirit, and I tie that into decision-making, focusing on divine input, and then giving them a framework to actually make sound decisions.
Wow.
Excellent. Man.
Preston, this book is so needed, man. Just being around guys who are in, in corporate America, middle management or above, and even below, if you want to call it that. Man, is this needed. So I'm really, really grateful that God moved in you to produce this book, and the value that I think it's going to add to so many people. So thank you for that. And so how can folks find out more about you, follow you maybe on social media? I know you've got a website. You do some executive coaching yourself, I think, and in some ways too. So share a little bit about that. So how people.
You bet. If folks are more interested, want to learn more about my platform, go to PrestonPoor.com. It's pretty simple. And my last name is Poor, like I have no money with an E on the end. So it's PrestonPoor.com.
You're poor in spirit, Preston.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's right. Go check that out. It talks a lot about not only the disciple leader on there, but another book called 21 Days to Sound Decision Making, right?
That's available electronically.
The Disciple Leader is available out there on it. You can buy the book in audio format, electronic format, or hardback anywhere across America right now. The cool thing is if you're flying, it's in airports across America on Choice Book Racks.
That's great.
Some news or something like that. They put that out there. So I'm very blessed by that. The other thing I'd mention is that we've done a podcast. I think I talked about that in our, when we were doing our, we weren't on air, but we talked about that. The fun thing about that is it's a limited edition. We did 11 episodes, an intro, and then one on each chapter, interviewing corporate executives, men and women across America about the disciple leader. Actually, they read the book and read a chapter and came in and gave us their thoughts on what that looks like living out their faith in the workplace. So go check that podcast out. Don't want to detract from the CLC piece, but there might be a supplemental thing for you to learn. And the last thing I'd mention to you is that my heart's desire is to actually, instead of doing all this sexy book writing and public speaking, my heart's to disciple people. Hmm. So I'm going to run a mastermind beginning in late February. And I think this podcast will air in early February. But if you want to go to my website or send me a note, I'm going to do a 4-week mastermind using the disciple leader material and content about building people's skills, not only in terms of discipleship, but also leadership around that. So that's how you can get in touch with me and the things that I would recommend people engage with.
Man, that sounds amazing. Holy cow, how cool would that be to jump into a mastermind and have you walk someone through to be discipled through that, man. That sounds incredible. So that's amazing. Great. Hey, Preston Poor, man. Thank you for joining us here on the Empowered Manhood Podcast.
Thanks for having me.